future of personalized medicine will be. But at the end of the day, if you can't get access to the testing, then it's just research, it's just talk. And it's my job to try to implement pharmacogenomics so that our doctors can use it on a regular basis. And I can tell you that it has been a major struggle, that as good and as reasonable as it seems to be, it actually doesn't happen automatically. And part of the problem is that most of our doctors didn't grow up in the personalized medicine era. And if they didn't learn about it while they were practicing, they don't know about it because it wasn't part of their DNA like it's going to be part of your DNA. I mean, it's going to be something that you will never forget. You will have it as part of your practice. It'll be second nature to you. That wasn't the case. That is not the case for the majority of the doctors who are practicing today. And so, therefore, it has been a struggle to try to convince people that this is what you should be doing. This is what we need to be doing in the future to prevent adverse events with therapeutics. And then we also have another problem. It's a somewhat unique UCSF problem. It's called the ivory tower syndrome. You know, we're dealing with the best of the best here at UCSF, and they are the international leaders in every field that you can think of. The problem, I mean, that's great news. The bad news is that, you know, sometimes you can't tell them what to do. You can't say, well, here's a better way. And by the way, this is something that your colleagues are doing, but you're not. And that actually has been part of the problem. So I've been doing this now for over a decade, and it's been pretty much a hit or miss. And what I'm going to do today is pretty much talk about the tests that we have done, that we are doing, and the reasons behind those tests. And then, of course, we did some DNA on some of you all, and I will have some of those results today. So this is sort of, you know, like the award show today. Well, you heard who the best of the now you're going to hear the worst. So just a quick overview. You know why we're doing this. It's because we want to try to avoid medical mistakes that are made. This is the third leading cause of death in the United States, medical mistakes. You know, and the majority of these mistakes are medication related. So, you know, we don't really do the wrong surgery on the wrong people anymore, you know, and it's not things that are obvious that can be fixed. It is things that are more insidious, and that's the therapeutics that we give, that we think that it works for everybody, and we hope that we can get a desirable effect, but sometimes it doesn't happen. That coupled with the fact that most of our drugs that we give willy-nilly actually only have between a 25 and 75% efficacy rate. That, in fact, there is no drug that we can say works for everybody all the time. This is a slide that you won't see anywhere else because pharma has hidden it from us. They don't want the world to know that your drugs that you're prescribing or that you're giving only has a 50% efficacy rate in some cases. Now, some of these, like the oncology drugs, okay, I can give them a pass because you have nothing else to go on, and it's sort of desperation in a lot of cases. Here we are. We're giving a very cytotoxic drug, and we hope that a quarter of these individuals will actually benefit from it, with three-quarters of them probably not benefiting from it. But if you do nothing, then that's not going to be good either. And the analgesics, maybe we do a little bit better job, but even that is not 100%. So on the one hand, we're causing harm. And on the other hand, we're not doing good. How can we do better? This is really what precision medicine is all about. And so the key and for where I sit in my office when people say, well, we should offer this test. We should make this test available because look how much we can gain from it. Well, it doesn't matter what the science says. It comes down to these three things, that you have to convert genotype data into clinical management decisions. If a doctor is not going to change what he or she is going to do with the genotype data, then it just becomes FYI. And I'm not in that business. I can't afford to do testing just for your information only. outside, of course, in this course. But we want to make sure that this can lead to some type of decision that hopefully will improve outcomes. And it's all evidence-based. You can't just say, well, we think that this will improve outcomes. You have to show that. And so a lot of the things that we do in my laboratory in terms of a research point of view is the clinical trials necessary to prove that something works when you make a medical decision. You know, the test itself is not going to cure anybody. It's all between the ears, and it's all between what the doctors are going to do with that information. And if nothing's being done, then we move on. So what are the three types of decisions? And I'll be giving you examples of all of these. For drugs that we really don't have a lot of alternatives, we can optimize dosing for maximum efficacy and toxicity avoidance. It's sort of a combination of the next two. Sometimes we don't have options, and we just want to make what we're doing today better. On the other hand, where we do have options, we can select drugs that avoid side effects, particularly catastrophic side effects, then it's well worth doing this. We can avoid that drug and avoid that outcome. And that becomes somewhat sometimes of a math problem, because you have to ask the question, well, how many people are we going to test that we're going to affect the outcomes on? And if it's 1 in 100, you might say, well, you know, maybe you live with that one person who has the adverse outcome, and you don't do testing of the other 99. Because this is not a glucose. This is not something that we can do, push a button, get a result in 30 seconds. These are tests that require many hours. A lot of labor is involved, $50 to $100 in many cases. And so it does come at a price tag. But at the same time, if you were that one person who had the wrong genotype and you were the one to be projected of having an adverse event, then it doesn't become a matter of math. It becomes a matter of compassion. We have to do this. We have to protect that one person, even if it means doing a lot of testing and doing a lot of expense for the other 99. So these are some of the conundrums that we have to face as we move forward with this as a university, not just as an individual. And then sometimes it's just a matter of selecting the drugs that we predict will have the highest rate of therapeutic efficacy. So it's the yin and the yang. You want to avoid toxicity. You want to improve efficacy. Sometimes we give drugs. They don't do any harm, and that's good news. But then they don't do any good either. And we're spending money, and we're giving these people medications that don't work. So we need to be able to always framework the individual cases into one of these three questions. What is the ultimate management decision that's going to be made? Now, I want to also differentiate between testing for pharmacogenomics and precision medicine versus testing for genetic diseases. And it's very important to understand that we're not testing to determine the presence or absence of a rare disease. You know, if you have the Huntington's gene, then the degree of penetrance is very high. You'll get Huntington's disease. It's fatal, and there's not much we can do about it. That's not something that we did on anybody here. We're not interested. And the medical ethical issues of genetic testing are huge, and it's one that we have avoided. Instead, we are involved with understanding why some drugs work in some individuals and don't work in another. And this has been a lower bar in terms of ethics. We're not saying that you're going to get a disease. We're saying that if you take this medication, it might not work or it might do harm. And that's very different from saying that, you know, you're going to get Alzheimer's and therefore we're not going to hire you because we think that you're going to be useless in 10 years, you know, from a workplace standpoint. Those have major ethical issues that we don't have to so much worry about here. And we've had a lot of discussions with the ethicists here at UCSF. The first couple of times we did this, we disclosed names of people in class of what their genotype was, And they came back to us and said, yeah, we don't think that that's such a good idea. And so the results that I'm going to show you are based on your code, and I hope that you've remembered what your code is. If you don't, then we can go look it up. But I myself don't have access to that code, because if I knew that you were a star 2, star 3, 2C19 genotype, then you're going to fail on your next exam. That's why they think that, you know, maybe I might have influence on your exam if I know what your genotype is, which is absolutely ridiculous. And so what we have couched it as, and the reason they've allowed us to continue, is that this is, think of it as saying that so-and-so has an allergy to eating peanuts. So if that's you, we're not going to say that this is something necessarily bad for you. It's not necessarily a stigma that's attached. It just means, okay, I got to avoid peanuts, peanut butter, and products of that nature. It's the same thing, in my opinion. We're doing DNA analysis, but the analysis just means that you need to avoid certain medications and that those medications are going to be only useful if you have a need for those medications. It's just like, you know, we don't have to eat peanuts. It's not like because I'm not eating peanuts that I won't get promoted next year. So science of understanding the correlation of a genotype and their response to drugs. The reason I bring this up is that these are schools that have done genotyping in their classes and have been reprimanded. Stanford down the road, Duke, Illinois, Iowa. And what they did was they used this product called 23andMe, and I know that you've heard some talks about this. This is a whole genome genotype where you do get information on Alzheimer's, on diabetes, on risk for these genetic diseases, and they did not provide counseling. They did not say, well, this is what this means for you. This is what you should do in the future, how you should look at this. You know, the BRCA1 gene and the BRCA2 gene is a predisposition to breast cancer. So these are very significant medical as well as social issues. We got away from all of that. And UCSF attorneys have agreed with us. Just a couple of definitions. Maybe you've seen these two terms used somewhat interchangeably. Pharmacogenetics and pharmacogenomics are actually slightly different. The genomics term refers to multiple variants that each have a small effect and involve a complex pathway. Multiple genes, each of them will have maybe a 5 or 10% influence. I'll show you an example of that. And then a single SNP, or maybe one or two SNPs in a particular gene that can have a large effect, is a pharmacogenetic test. So we have a pharmacogenomic and genetic tests, and unfortunately the literature kind of uses it interchangeably. I fall into that trap too. I just sort of say one thing when I really mean the other. I don't think it really matters that much, but it is different. So just bear in mind that they're not technically the same terms. We've been, as I mentioned, heavily involved with doing clinical trials on pharmacogenomic genes to try to understand how they might get used in clinical practice. And you would think that naturally the pharma company would be very much encouraging us to do this work. It makes their drug better, reduces side effects. Point of fact is we don't get any encouragement from them. They're not interested in promoting clinical science. And why is that? Many of you may end up going into pharma, and maybe down the road you can change this opinion. But as it is today, pharma doesn't want to limit the population of subjects that could or should receive a drug. They hope that they are going to be able to find the next aspirin that's going to work for everybody. At least they think that it will work for everybody. We know that even aspirin doesn't work for everybody in terms of pain relief. It's more expensive to do drug delivery, to develop it, to implement. They're not in the lab medicine business like I am, so they don't really understand it. A pharma company does not encourage pharmacogenomic testing on a routine clinical basis. Now, having said that, they are responsible for delivering pharmacogenetic data when they submit their drugs to the FDA. But the FDA kind of puts it into a file, and they don't look at it until there are complaints or there are adverse events. When people have trouble, then they'll go back and they'll say, well, you know, maybe we could have predicted that. Maybe we should then think about a laboratory test in conjunction with this drug. But when they first submit the data, they're not so much interested in the genetics. They're interested in the efficacy and the toxicity, the actual incidence of efficacy and toxicity. And it's not really towards after the drug has been approved during surveillance, and FDA does keep a watch on adverse events, will they go back and look at that data? Seems a little bit backwards. You think, well, gee, wouldn't you want to know first if there is an interaction between a drug and a side effect? And the answer is no. I hope I don't feel come across as being overly harsh, but this is the reality as I see it. And in fact, I think that in the future, especially when some of you get out there and say, well, you know, this is dumb. We need to be doing pharmacogenomic testing for anything that we do, that in the future we will see this, that companies will encourage personalized or precision medicine. And this is my hypothesis, that there have been a number of drugs that have been removed from the market that have done very well. Vioxx for rheumatoid arthritis was wildly successful. But a handful of people developed a mitral valve problem, and the FDA pulled the drug. And here's a couple of others. Ephedrin is a weight loss drug, also a sympathomimetic amine. Bacol was a statin that was recalled. And so the concept here is that there was no pharmacogenomic testing involved when these drugs were released, and no post-release surveillance to determine, gee, we could have maybe predicted, and we could maybe save this drug by linking it to a laboratory test. How many tens and hundreds of millions of dollars were spent to get that drug into clinical practice only to see it go away? So some of that, I think, is can be rescued, and we're seeing some of that now. There are some innovative small pharma companies that are taking some of these substrates and some of these chemicals and rethinking the problem, doing a search for relevant pharmacogenomic interactions and then determining whether or not this is going to be salvageable. Still has to be a lot cheaper than starting with a new molecule. So it's not trivial for the university to offer a laboratory test. We have a working committee that looks at all of these things. this is the Clinical Translational Science Institute here at UCSF. It's been funded by the NIH for hundreds of millions of dollars for the last 10 years. The whole idea is to bring scientific discovery from the laboratory research bench to the bedside and ultimately to the community. And pharmacogenomics fits into this perfectly because there's a lot of work that's being done here and that we need to implement that. If it doesn't get from here to here, then again, we're back to FYI. And so the chair of this department here, now the dean of this school, is part of this working group. the former chair of the medical genetics section, who has recently just left UCSF, much to our chagrin, but Dr. Nussbaum is no longer with us, so we're sort of in an interim situation now. This is my boss here at Lab Medicine. I report to Lab Medicine. Dean's office gave us some support early on for looking at some of this work. You know, they look at pharmacogenomics, not from a medical standpoint, but from a from a dollar standpoint. You know, oh, gee, maybe we can get some intellectual property from the stuff that you're doing. So they're keeping an eye on us. And as I mentioned, lots of research that's being done here in the PSPG program, the School of Pharmacology and Pharmacogenomics. Many of the discoveries are made here, and we're a better place to implement them than from the place that they were discovered. And one of the things I'll be talking about is some of the work that was done by Dr. Giacomini and Kretz on metformin. Still a story yet to be told here. And then this is me. This ends up being my job. All right, so who's the driver of pharmacogenomics? This is a very curious question because it hasn't been doctors. It hasn't been the lab medicine group. It has, in fact, been the Food and Drug Administration. So there was a graduate student here about 10, 12 years ago by the name of Li Zong. She worked for Kathy Giacomini. And she went to the FDA and helped create the Center for Drug Education and Research, which has been very active in promoting personalized medicine. Now, let's take a step back, and let me tell you about what is the FDA. The FDA is a regulatory body that you probably know is responsible for approving drugs and devices. So if you have a new medication or if you have some type of left ventricular assist device, you need to get that approved by the FDA, and that's a 5 to 10 year process. The laboratory tests also fall into that category. All of the tests that I do, or many of them, are approved by the FDA. So it's a sort of a you bring your stuff, and we'll tell you if we like it, and we'll either give you a check mark or we'll send you back. And if you don't get the check mark, then that drug doesn't get sold, and that device doesn't get sold, and companies go under. So it's a huge enterprise. Lots of important things go on, loaded full of important clinical scientists, but not much on leading, really more on saying, well, you bring us, and then we'll tell you if we think the evidence is there. When Li Zong got there and some of the other people, Les Lesko and Janet Woodcock, they changed the model a little bit with the FDA. They said, we see this slide of 100,000 deaths per year due to medical mistakes, and we want to do something about it. We want to influence where we can, where it was legal for us to make influence, to try to change practice, to try to say, well, pharmacogenomics is something we should be doing, not just talking about it, not just doing research. So how did they sort of force the hand, or at least how are they trying to force the hand of doctors to begin doing pharmacogenomic testing? It was actually pretty clever. What they did was they said, well, we don't handle lab tests. We can't determine reimbursement. We can't force doctors to order. But what we can do is we can tell manufacturers of drugs, pharma company, to put labeling on their product. Labeling to suggest that pharmacogenomic testing or genotyping is recommended prior to dosing. And what that does is it bumps the awareness up right away because the FDA has made these proclamations. And at least I think in theory what they were hoping was that it would drive pharmacogenomic testing from a medical legal standpoint, that if you didn't follow a recommendation listed by the FDA and an adverse event happens, okay, who's going to be put on the hot seat? The doctor who ignored that recommendation and the outcome that perhaps could have been avoided had pharmacogenomic testing been avoided. So this was their goal. They started a decade ago. They started with things that weren't really that widely used. Irinotecan is a colon cancer drug. We have some data on some of you on irinotecan. azathioprine is a anti-rheumatoid disease drug. It's also used in leukemias and in ulcerative colitis. So they sort of flew up these little trial balloons. No one's going to really get too upset when a small minority of people have this warning label on their medication. And when they didn't get any pushback, then they upped the stakes. And this is the more recent list of drugs that they have opined that manufacturers should either have a relabeling or even to the next extreme, issuance of a black box warning. So black box warning is even the next level. It says that, we have warned you. And you should not just manufacturers, but clinicians be aware of the toxicities that have occurred. And so this is a list that I will be talking about in this next remaining part of this lecture. Okay, just a couple of quick reviews. You know this. We can genotype and we can phenotype. It's always important to say, well, how do they relate? What are the genes that predict the phenotypes? We've identified basically four classifications. The extensive metabolizers are the wild type. And then these are three of the genes of the CYP450 showing that this is the majority of people are in the extensive metabolism genotype. Now, if you have one copy of a poor metabolism gene and one copy of a wild type gene, then perhaps you are in this intermediate metabolism genotype. And there are also genes that are directly associated with intermediate metabolism. You don't necessarily need to be heterozygous. If you're homozygous, however, for a poor metabolism gene, such as STAR2 or STAR3 for 2C9 or 2C19, then you are at greatest risk for a drug-induced side effect due to diminished drug elimination and or lack of therapeutic effect. We don't see so much of this, but there is the other side of the coin. There are people who are ultra-rapid metabolizers. They either have multiple copies of a wild-type gene or they have a mutation that gives a preferred Michaelis-Menten-type kinetics for that enzyme. Remember, we are talking enzymes here, and we're talking a substrate and reaction rate, and the conformation is determined by the genotype. And there are some of you in this room who we've identified as being ultra-rapid metabolizers. So we don't do pharmacogenomic or genetic testing on everything because it doesn't always make sense. So here is sertraline, and these are the four different phenotypes here, and you can see that the percent drug dosage necessary to maintain some therapeutic effect is unchanged. And so, therefore, pharmacogenomic testing will not be necessary here. No one has asked us to do testing for sertraline. But then this is imipramine, which is a tricyclic antidepressant. We don't use so much anymore. But you can see here that large effect, if you are a poor metabolizer, you need less because you're not going to break down the drug at the same rate as someone who is an extensive metabolizer. And therefore, you start off with maybe a quarter of or a fifth of the dose for the wild type. And then the opposite would be the case. If you are a ultra-rapid metabolizer, you need more drug because it's breaking down too quickly, and we want to be able to maintain some degree of therapeutic efficacy. Yeah, question?
For CYP2C19, having STAR2, STAR2 versus STAR2, STAR3, is it the same? Because they're both
expressing non-functional. You know, it's not that black and white. The STAR2 does have some residual activity, whereas STAR3 has less. So if you are a STAR3, it's worse than STAR2. STAR3 is a little bit less activity-wise. Yeah?
What determines the normal dosage of the drug in extensive metabolizers considered to be normal?
Yeah, so this is what the FDA is looking for. They want you to determine, when you submit data to them, what is the dose that you're going to think is going to work for the majority of the population? And that's the wild type. So they don't pre-phenotype the individual. And they may not even know what genes interact with these drugs. I mean, they do know, but they don't actually do any pharmacogenomic testing in the clinical trial. So if you're taking a drug in a clinical trial, there is no dose adjustments on the basis of your genotype. That's done later, if at all. I'm sorry?
Where does this data come from?
Oh, well, so this is after the fact. I mean, this tricyclic antidepressant has been around for 40 years. So these were all done well after the drug was submitted. You know, and we already knew what the normal dosage would be in clinical practice. And then somebody did a study and actually linked dosage that we're required to maintain a therapeutic concentration and genotype. Is there another question? Okay. So I said I was going to go into some specific examples. Many of these examples were things that we did for a while. Warfarin has been sort of hit or miss. So I want to go over just a couple of slides discussing this story. So warfarin is an oral anticoagulant. It is something that's used to treat patients to prevent thrombosis who have a heart attack or who have had a stroke, atrial fibrillation, venous thrombosis, either a pulmonary emboli or a deep vein thrombosis. So what we want to do is prolong coagulation so that these individuals don't clot to the same extent that a normal person might. And what we do is we measure the PTINR, the prothrombin time international normalized ratio. Normal people are set at 1.0. For warfarin, we want to have a PTINR between 2 and 3. It just means that their blood is thinned out a little bit. They're not going to clot as readily as a wild type or somebody who doesn't have any of these diseases. Unfortunately, warfarin has a very complex dose-response relationship. This is the key figure here. 7% of outpatients suffer a major hemorrhagic event within the first month of giving the drug. And most of those are people who end up with a bleed. And if the bleed occurs in the brain, then we have a subarachnoid hemorrhage or we have a hemorrhagic stroke, and now you really have a sick person here if that person survives. So we've known this for a number of years. Warfarin has been available for 30 or 40 years, and it's only been recently that people have decided that maybe we could do a better job by doing pharmacogenomic testing. And so this is why the FDA relabeled warfarin about 8 years ago. This is a typical population-based slide. You've probably seen variances of this, where you have a group of people like a group of people here, and if all of you were on to be on warfarin, the starting dose necessary to maintain a stable INR will differ. Some of you may require 18 milligrams a week. Others may require 29. And you can't just look at that person and say, oh, I can predict that you're going to be 22. You have to do testing. And even when you do, so the standard dose is 35 milligrams per week, which is 5 milligrams per day. And under that condition, only about 35% of the individuals on the standard dose will have the right dose of an INR between 2 and 3. About a quarter will have INRs that are greater than 3, and these are the people that are at risk for bleeding. And then another third will have INRs that are less than 2, and these are people who are going to be sub-efficacious. So this is the perfect example here, perfect storm. You've got toxicity on the one hand, you've got sub-efficacious on the other hand, and then in the middle, okay, we're doing okay with these patients, but that's only a third of the whole population once given 35 milligrams. So what is done in clinical practice? You get this test done every week. My mom's on warfarin, and she gets a test done every week. Now, nowadays, she can do testing on herself. She has a little finger stick and does her own testing, and she's very compliant. Not too many 90-year-olds can do that. My mom's 90. So what has happened then is that you go to the doctor and you get INR testing, and let's say it turns out to be 4. Well, then the doctor says, 5 milligrams is probably too much. We're going to drop you down to 3.5 or 3, and hope that works, come back in a week. And maybe that works. And maybe in that interim between when they change the doses recommendation and when they were supposed to come back, they had a hemorrhagic stroke. Because, again, most of these adverse events occur immediately. And, therefore, you sometimes don't get a chance to make an adjustment. You've already put the person out on the plank, and you hope that they don't fall into the water. And where I practice at San Francisco General Hospital, I don't know if you've ever been there, it's a facility for the indigent population. Days like today, a little bit rainy, a little bit cold, overcast, my ED is full right now. I have all these homeless people. They just want a place to have shelter. Sometimes we have these frequent flyers, and the guy goes, "Hey, Doc, I got chest pain. I gotta stay in tonight." You know, and it's okay. What can I do? You know, we have to take you. The point is that when we give warfarin to the homeless, they don't come back for their INR testing. We don't get a second chance to dose adjust. You get one shot. Most of the time, they're trying to figure out where they're going to sleep that night or where they're going to get food for their stomachs. And they're not thinking about, trying to dose adjust their INRs. They may be taking their medications, but they're not certainly compliant with appointments. And so we see a lot of people who don't show up for their appointments. Sometimes you get one shot, and you hope you get it right. And this is where pharmacogenomics fits in. So this is it is a pharmacogenomic test because it involves the pharmacokinetic aspect of it. So 2C9 is a drug, an enzyme that metabolizes the drug. And then the vitamin K reductase enzyme is the pharmacodynamic aspect. It needs to bind to warfarin in order for it to work, or rather, in order for warfarin to work, it binds to the enzyme and inhibits the reconversion of oxidized vitamin K back to reduced vitamin K. Reduced vitamin K is necessary as a cofactor for converting these factors, blood factors 2, 7, 9, and 10, to functional variances, functional counterparts. This is how coagulation works, that we want to be able to produce active factors, and if we want to anticoagulate, if we want to prevent clotting, then we block these pathways. And this is what warfarin does. Okay, but this is the pharmacogenomic aspects of warfarin, 2C9 and VCOR. And so the standard dose, as I said, is about 5 milligrams per day. And if you are a wild type for 2C9, it comes out to about 4.5. And that works for the people who are star 1, star 1. But if you have the star 2 gene or the star 3 gene or homozygous for that combination, the amount of drug needed to maintain a stable INR is half, is about 2 milligrams. So if you give 5 milligrams to a 90-year-old woman who has a star 2, star 3 genotype, like my mother, that would have been an overdose. That would have been double of what it should have been. And then this is the VCOR relationship. The GG is the wild type. And so, again, GG, 2C9, star 1, star 1, there's your 5 milligrams. But if you have the A genotype, and many of you in this room have the A genotype, then you're going to need less drug. Okay, so it's not 5 milligrams. It's 2 milligrams, even if you're star 1, 2C9, homozygous. And if you're the extreme, the VCOR, AA, star 2, star 3, or star 3, star 3, 2C9, then you need less than a milligram. That's one-fifth of the dose for wild type. And given a drug that is five times overdose will give you the that little image I showed you, the little brain that's bleeding. This is when they end up at my colleague's table. You don't want to be in my colleague's table. My colleagues are autopsy pathologists.
I have a question.
Yeah.
What do you mean by AMG again?
Okay, so what they didn't do well, which is really stupid, they didn't designate the VCOR as a star 1, star 2, like they should have with the 2C9 and 2C19 and the 2D6. So the GG is just a substitution, amino acid substitution variant, as opposed to the A, a nucleotide substitution. So it's just a genotype. Okay, so this is how VCOR and 2C9 fits in with the other known parameters that predict warfarin dosing. What is not known, unfortunately, if you go back to this slide, look at some of these people who are wild type, but they need 10 and 12 milligrams per day of warfarin in order to maintain a stable INR. These are hypermetabolizers or people who are not responsive and need more drug. And we have not found the genes that control the people who need more than 5 milligrams per day, of which there are many in our patient population. So getting back to the key slide here that I showed, what medical decisions are we going to make on the basis of pharmacogenomic testing. And when it came to warfarin, when we began 10 years ago, there was no other acceptable oral anticoagulant. And so we were stuck with that. Now that's changed. We now have some other alternatives. They're 3 to 4 times more expensive, but they don't require pharmacogenomic testing. So there's some good news and bad news. But dosing algorithms then become the key because we couldn't get rid of it. We just want to make the drug that we're using better. And an algorithm was created first by these people in England, where they looked at some type of statistical regression model that involved genotyping, age, and height, and correlated that to the actual genotype, the actual warfarin dose needed to maintain a stable INR. I wanted to see how well their predictive model matched against what was in real practice. And what they showed was that the model was pretty good. You can see that what's low was predicted, and what's high was predicted, a value from anywhere from 2 to 6. So this gave us a lot of hope that says, hey, maybe we can do a better job with warfarin and that we can improve on outcomes. This was a study done in Caucasians. Unfortunately, that doesn't work here in San Francisco because that would be a minority of many of the people that we see. And so a bigger algorithm has been created from the International Warfarin Consortium. They have a website. You can see the address here. This is a very complex algorithm that requires all of these information. There are co-medications that can inhibit 2C9 or that can stimulate 2C9. There are these different genotypes I mentioned. Here's VCOR. Here's 2C9. Smoking history, age, height, ethnicity. You plug in all these data, you push this button right here, out pops out a number. And that number says, we predict that 3.5 milligrams will be the best dose that you can use on your patient when you're first starting your patient out with warfarin. Don't give 5 milligrams. 5 milligrams would be too much for this patient. Give 3.5, and we think that you can do a better job. Okay? So that's warfarin. Unfortunately, like I say, there have been alternative drugs that have been made available, and people are trying to move away from warfarin. there's also issue with reimbursement right now, that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid are only reimbursing warfarin in the context of a clinical trial. There have been a number of clinical trials. There's still some ongoing that have suggested that whereas you can do a better job at predicting INR compliance, it hasn't reduce the incidence of adverse events. And so there hasn't been enough clinical experience to actually prove that warfarin improves outcome. And until that happens, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid are denying payments. You sort of have two sides of the government kind of fighting each other. You know, you get the FDA says, you know, we want to promote personalized medicine. We think this is the right thing we should do as a nation. And then you got the Center for Medicare and Medicaid who does the reimbursement, and they can say, we can't afford you. That's good in principle. Show me the data that it actually improves outcomes. And until you do that, we're not going to pay for it. So this is sort of the harsh reality. Having said that, I can tell you that in other countries, in Asia in particular, warfarin pharmacogenomic testing is catching on. We're seeing a lot more there. And maybe that will stimulate our government to act. Part of the reason there is that warfarin is cheaper, and whereas the pharma companies here want you to go off warfarin. They want you to go on dabigatran, and then you don't have to worry about pharmacogenomic testing. So it's just very complex issues here that we're dealing with. Okay, tamoxifen. Here's another story here. Tamoxifen is another drug that's been out there for a long time, used to treat women who have breast cancer and who have been treated with either chemotherapy or surgery to prevent breast cancer recurrence. It's a hormone that stimulates, that blocks estrogen receptors. And in recent years, we have alternative drugs. We have the aromatase inhibitors that are more expensive, but yet they are easier to use because they don't require this pharmacogenomic interaction. So let me walk you through that. Tamoxifen been around for, again, 30, 40 years. But only in the last 10 years has the pharmacogenetics been worked out, and it's a combination of 2D6 and 3A4 and 3A5. This is tamoxifen. Tamoxifen is a prodrug. You know what prodrugs are. They don't work until they get metabolized to the active compound. Clopidogrel, which we'll be talking about, is also a prodrug. So here's tamoxifen. Breaks down to N-desmethyl and then ultimately to endoxifen by either one of these two pathways. Now, if you have a mutation in 2D6, more so than in 3A4, 3A5, you don't produce tamoxifen to the same extent, and you're not protecting your breasts from a recurrent disease. So tamoxifen has about a 50 to 100 times more potency in blocking estrogen receptors than the parent compound. So the key here is that can we maintain a minimum concentration of endoxifen? This is the allele frequency for 2D6, and the relevant ones are STAR4, which is a null gene, and STAR10, which is a reduced metabolism genotype. If we look at the outcomes analysis, and this one we do have pretty good data on, this is from the Mayo Clinic. This is relapse-free time and disease-free survival of women who were treated with tamoxifen on standard dose, 20 milligrams. If they are either heterozygous or wild type, they had a better outcome than if they were STAR4. You can see here that these women did not do as well. They died a lot sooner and in larger numbers. So this suggests that tamoxifen is not working in these women and that something else should be given, perhaps a different drug, but perhaps a higher concentration of tamoxifen. Both of these things are being considered right now. So you might just argue, okay, well, then why don't we just forget about tamoxifen? We have the alternative. Yes, it's a little bit more expensive. These are the aromatase inhibitors. They do the same thing. They block the production of estrogen from the precursors. And by the way, they're also abused by weightlifters and bodybuilders and people who want to get bigger and stronger because it does the same thing as basically injecting yourself with anabolic steroids or testosterone. So why not just give that to everybody? Well, the problem is that aromatase inhibitors only work in the postmenopausal setting, that if you are in premenopause, and many of our women who have breast cancer are, then you have to induce menopause chemically by giving a drug called Lupron. This is chemical menopause induction in order for us to use this aromatase inhibitor. And a lot of women don't want to be in menopause. You know, they want to be able to have somewhat of a normal life. with menopause comes a lot of other problems, like osteoporosis, like hypercholesterolemia and heart disease, vaginal dryness, hot flashes. These are not things things that women want to do. And so the aromatase inhibitors are reserved for women who are in their postmenopausal years, and tamoxifen is the drug of choice for women in premenopausal or perimenopausal for these reasons. Codeine, there's a black box warning on codeine. This is another prodrug. Obviously, this is a woman who is breastfeeding here. Sometimes codeine, or at least at one time, was used to alleviate postpartum pain. So if you had a child and you're giving an opiate, codeine, you need to be particularly careful because it is metabolized to morphine via 2D6. And it's not so much the problem with people who are poor metabolizers. If you're a poor metabolizer, you're just not getting any analgesic effect. You're not getting any pain relief. But the people who are ultra metabolizers, these in particular for 2D6 would be multiple gene copies. These women are producing too much morphine from the codeine that they're giving, that they're actually overdosing their child with morphine if they're taking codeine and breastfeeding at the same time. Morphine crosses through to breast milk, and these women have accidentally killed many of these children. That there is a black box warning because of deaths due to morphine overdoses in the neonate period. You can imagine that that's got to be the worst nightmare ever. This is the allele frequency for the ultra metabolizer, showing that some of the African populations have the highest incidences and the Asian populations the lowest incidence. I mentioned that this kind of work is ongoing, where new gene discoveries are being made by the pharmacogenomic programs and the graduate students that we have here. And if you are interested in doing some type of clinical research, some of these projects may be possible to do as a thesis project. MAY2K is one of the transporter proteins. And we focus so much on metabolism, and rightfully so. Most of the pharmacogenomic interactions relate to drug metabolism, either hyper or hypo. But the transport genes can effectively do the same thing. If you can't get the drug into the site of action, or if the drug can't get out of the site of action, then you're going to have variances in response. Some cases, toxicity. Some cases, lack of efficacy. This is a pretty new science that hasn't really yet reached clinical practice. There's really only one example that I know of where a transport protein is used, and that's in statins. There is a transport gene that predicts statin-induced rhabdomyolysis, which is extensive muscle disease. MAY2K has some promise, just discovered a couple of years ago. And this is the relationship of MAY2K to the drug metformin. So metformin is an oral anti-diabetic or anti-glycemic agent. So if you have diabetes and your glucose cannot be controlled by diet or exercise, then you could get metformin. Metformin brings the glucose levels down. Now, one of the ways that we monitor glucose status is a test called the hemoglobin A1C. The hemoglobin A1C allows you to determine how well what is your average glucose levels over the past 120 days. And the reason it's able to do that is because glucose forms an irreversible bond with hemoglobin A, to form A1C. And because red cells have a 120-day life, we can determine what is your average hemoglobin levels over that time period. And it's done in every diabetic. Any of you who are diabetics, you know this. You probably have A1C testing done routinely. So this is the study that they published a few years ago. They noticed that the GG genotype for this MAY2K gene was wild type, and that a certain percentage, a small percentage, had a heterozygous, and even smaller percentage have a homozygosity for this variant. Now, what we have over here is the mean change in hemoglobin A1C from these individuals given a standard metformin dose. And what you see here for the homozygous wild type and the heterozygous, a 13 to 16% drop in hemoglobin A1C. So that's good news. That means that your average glucose during that four-month period of time was 15% lower. At least the A1C says that your glucose is better controlled than it was the previous month. This is the objective of metformin use. But then you look at the AA genotype, and what we see here is a change of only 6%, from 13 to just 6%. And, in fact, the percentage actually went the wrong way. It's a minus, which means that it increased. Well, basically it says that the metformin doesn't work in people who are AA genotype, that you should use a different oral hypoglycemic drug like a thiourea or a glyburide. There are a number of hypoglycemic drugs that are available. Metformin just happens to be one of the more popular ones. I like metformin because it doesn't really produce toxicity. You can overdose on metformin, and you don't actually get hypoglycemia. It doesn't bring you down to below normal. You might get a little bit of lactate, but it doesn't really give you the same degree of hypoglycemia. So I presented this data to our diabetes people. And I basically said, you know, we have a laboratory test now that can predict whether or not your metformin is going to work for your patients or not, these newly diagnosed diabetics who are being considered for metformin. And quite to my surprise, they said, you know, we're not really interested in this test. I'm going, well, why not? He says, because we practice the trial and error methodology. I said, well, what does that mean? We try it, and after 4 months, if the A1C doesn't drop, we go to something else. You know, we don't need a laboratory test. We've got it down. You know, we have a routine. We don't want to spend the $100 it'll take you to run this test. We'll just have the person come back, and, you know, if it's still high, then we'll go to something else. And I was shocked by it. You know, I'm thinking, these are intelligent, you know, and I don't want to denigrate my colleagues because they know what they're doing. And, you know, if they told me that they have a workaround, then I say, okay, I'm fine with that. And if I were a diabetic, I would still want to be in their hands. So, but they did say something on their way out the door, which kind of made me think a little bit here. They said, but, you know, what about metformin and pancreatic cancer? I went, what? And he says, yeah, let me show you the slide here. This is a slide, an observation made of an individual who did a study. These are people who have pancreatic cancer. Now, first of all, if you have pancreatic cancer, that's pretty much a death sentence right there. You don't survive very long with pancreatic cancer. And those people who were diabetic and treated with metformin for their diabetes versus pancreatic cancer diabetes who were not treated with metformin, okay? So this was not a metformin interventional trial. This was a, by the way, if you have diabetes and we give you metformin, you did better. And this is the Kaplan-Meier survival curves. These individuals did better than these individuals. They all had diabetes. They all had pancreatic cancer. Everything else was normalized. The only difference was metformin use. So metformin is being considered now for pancreatic cancer, which I think is great. We need whatever we can get. You know, pancreatic function, you've got cancer on the one hand, you've got diabetes on the other hand. You know, maybe they're linked. I am asking the question, all right, if this becomes standard care, which it might, then maybe now we should think about pharmacogenomic testing. Because we don't have this trial and error capability. We can't wait 6 years and say, oh, you know, it didn't work. Well, we shouldn't have done it. We don't have time to waste. We can do a predictive. If the person is treated with metformin, maybe they don't even have diabetes. Forget the diabetes part now. We're just treating pancreatic cancer with metformin. And if they have a MATE2K polymorphism, maybe we say, okay, it's not going to work for you. It's not going to get to the level that is going to protect you. And we need to do something else, maybe a Whipple's procedure, a very invasive surgical procedure. Okay, this is a hypothesis. This has not been tested. I don't have a database. We don't have anybody who's looking at this. The MATE2K was only discovered a couple of years ago. This is the kind of thing that I think will take in order to change outcomes and change a medical decision. The medical decision is pancreatic cancer, should we use metformin or not? And maybe the pharmacogenomic test will allow us to determine that. Okay? All right, Plavix. This is the black box warning. So Plavix is a prodrug, requires conversion to an active metabolite. Oh, okay. Let's do it.
5 minutes.
Very good. Sorry. Yeah, I sent it to Dr. Guo over the weekend, and she probably hasn't had a chance to upload it yet. Okay. So she will.
My other question is for the glucose one.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the change, the -0.14, let's say for DA, was just the change, the drop in glucose, which is what you want the patient has
The AA did not have that same degree of drop in A1C.
And then, so the GA and the A are like
AA is recessive homozygous, GG is like wild type.
In this case, it doesn't always work out that way.
For like the one where the warfarin.
Same thing. Just, but that's a coincidence. Sometimes AA,
okay,
yeah. I just changed it over the weekend, and Dr. Guo hasn't uploaded it yet, but she knows about it, and she hasn't got it.
Okay, this one.
I'll make an announcement.
The warfarin dosing, so if someone is like, you know, that 35% that usually is below the INR2, you want to increase the dose of warfarin because they're basically like...
They're not being protected.
From doses, right?
That's correct. Yeah, they're at risk. It's like you haven't done anything.
Yeah, they're at risk. Okay. So, have you... I'm just curious.
You can ask as many questions as you want.
Yeah, you were saying that your mom, like, you have to check every day or...
Not every day, but every week.
So then, like, that it is
right.
Can they themselves take, like, how do they know what dose to take?
So what my mom does is that she phones in the data to a nurse every week, and she looks at it. And then if she decides that you need to cut back, she'll call back and say, use half a pill today or half a pill tomorrow. And she'll actually cut the pill and give her a new prescription. That's one way. The other way is that because you're talking about vitamin K is found in leafy vegetables. She could be over anticoagulated because she ate a lot of broccoli that day or that week. And so she'll ask, the nurse will say, well, what has your diet changed? And have you been eating more vegetables lately? You need to change that.
Okay, so then they can just call in.
Right, but I can say that most people don't do this. Most people go to the doctor, and not every week, it's once a month, and they have this done, and they see the doctor, and they say, okay, do this, do that. And it's not ideal.
Hey.
All
right.
Good. How are you?
Good. So, I just turned it off.
So, yeah, so like, obviously, these guys are very particular about starting on time and ending on time.
Okay. Well, I've definitely done the first one.
So the questions for the exam should be pretty basic. You know, it's a requirement.
I already did it.
Like, all night, talk to you on it.
Yeah, no, I already said the third one.
Yeah, I sent you an email. I have 3 students coming this summer, 2 undergraduates and high school students. High school students from Lowell, the undergraduates from Stanford, the other undergraduates from Occidental.
Okay.
I'm wondering if there's a review paper that we can write together, maybe like on race and drugs. Something like that.
What do the students have to do with that?
They can help write it.
Okay.
So like last summer, the students were instrumental in doing all the PubMed searches and Freedom of Information Act requests.
Great. So they could be our legwork.
That's right.
So I lectured at the Science Club at Lowell 2 months ago. I bet you that student was there.
Good.
You might ask if she was at my lecture.
Okay.
Anyway, it doesn't matter.
So let's do something together. And Martina White's going to help. So that'd be great.
By the way, congratulations on your appointment to the President of the Gospel. That's huge.
I go there tomorrow.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big deal. I'm cheering.
Oh, it's a huge deal.
Yeah. That's why I think you and I should ride the other people together.
That's down.
The reason I got on that committee.
I'm down. You tell me, I'm down.
Yeah, I think the political paper was pretty good.
Yeah, you know, Louis is not the VA anymore.
So he's out?
Yeah. I don't know why, but what happened.
Well, you know, it's a political appointee. So
exactly. So he's no longer in charge, and I think the lawsuit's pretty much been dropped.
Oh, is that right?
I think so. It's not going to
come out. It's still a good party for us.
For sure.
All right. So you're going to...
I should talk about that.
You should.
I will.
You should, because it gets people mad.
Yeah.
The fact that 50% of the population is like, don't.
Yeah, we don't matter, you know?
And then, you know, as far as the medicine thing, actually, I don't know if I talked to you, but I talked to Gordon, Gordon Funk.
Okay, yeah, Gordon, I know you.
What do you say he's working on?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We're doing a stat trial.
So as part of the Precision Medicine Initiative, my big goal would be to see if he's a study in China.
Okay.
based in terms of heavy, my big goal. So I talked to Gordon about it. I talked to Jeff Oakley about it.
No, I already have DNA on several hundred Asians, Chinese from this thing. I already have the DNA because we're doing the shots. So it's a matter of getting IRB approval and, you know, and setting up some of the stuff.
Okay, what's up? Hey, easy. You didn't give out the results today.
That's next.
What time are you doing? I want to, are you being in early?
I hope to be done in 10 till.
Perfect. Today's my birthday, and I'm having, Sunday was my birthday, but I'm getting Jim Sun in my lab.
All right.
I have to sign the order.
I should come over.
I have to come.
Yeah, I'm going to make an announcement.
I changed it over the weekend. And Sue hasn't, Dr. Wall hasn't been able to put it up yet.
Okay.
Okay, if you could take your seats, please. So I have to apologize. The slides that were uploaded were the previous version. I added a few slides over the weekend. I gave it to Dr. Guo, and she hasn't had a chance to upload it. So you will have access to all the slides that I presented. Okay? Sorry for that confusion. So we left with the initial discussion on Plavix. So Plavix is a little similar to warfarin. Warfarin affects coagulation function, thrombus formation, and Plavix affects platelet function. So when you clot, it's a combination. There is clot, there's thrombus, and then there's platelets. They all kind of form this very complicated mesh. And if you want to try to prevent clotting, and you want to prevent aggregation, you give warfarin and you give Plavix. This is the black box warning 5 years ago that said we need to be careful for people who have who have low 2C19 activity, so they're star 2, star 3, because they're not able to convert Plavix to its active metabolite. And this cartoon kind of shows that. Here you have, it's an oral drug. If you go this way, you can produce the active metabolite, and this is the chemistry behind it here. This is the active drug. And what it does then, it binds to the P2Y12 receptor onto a platelet, and by binding the drug to the receptor, prevents binding of fibrinogen to the platelet. And fibrinogen is sort of like a Y-tube. It has two arms. It binds one platelet and connects another platelet by its second arm. And so you can join two, it's like two freight trains that are put together by a little connector. And if you can break that connection, or if you can block that that receptor, then they can't aggregate. And that's the whole objective, is you want to prevent platelets from aggregating. But if you don't have the conversion necessary in your liver, then it goes into this inactive production here, and then the Plavix doesn't work. Okay? So it's pretty simple. And here is the data. These are individuals who are underwent a angioplasty. I'm going to show you a movie. I hope I can. I can. Of what an angioplasty looks like. But what this data showed was that if you were wild type, and that's in the blue here, after angioplasty, you end up with a 8% adverse event rate at 450 days. If you have at least one copy of a STAR2 or STAR3 gene, you are a carrier for 2C19, your adverse event rate jumps to 12%. I mean, this is a 4% increase, a 50% higher incidence of adverse events than if you were wild type. And so this suggests that we should be doing testing of people undergoing angioplasty because Plavix is given to prevent rethrombosis. So let's see if I can get this to go. I don't think there's volume here, but try to walk you through it. Okay, so what they're doing is they're feeding the catheter from the femoral artery up into the, not sure how. Do you know how to do it?
This is one of the coolest things you'll see in medicine right here. So while they're doing this, I'm going to walk you through this.
I think it's like,
that's
being actually.
Basically, if you can imagine a pipe, there's crud in the pipe.
Yeah, because you can see like
this. And blood needs to go from one end to the other end, but it's being blocked by the crud.
It's like this,
everything south of that crud is not getting blood.
Yeah.
All being ischemic, meaning that it's having a cramp, but when you have a cramp.
Okay, well, let's just have to do the best we can.
One thing, or is it cramping the heart called the heart attack? So what they're doing is they're passing a wire, they're going right through your pipe right here. They pass the wire, it's really cool. They feed it up, goes up your chest, past your aorta, into your coordinate artery. Right,
yeah, there's not really volume. So
pass a little wire through the crud.
All right, well, thanks.
A little balloon, and open it up, and that's what you'll see.
Well, I'm not going to be able to enlarge it, but what you'll see is also, in addition to the inflation of the balloon, there'll be a stainless steel mesh that will be deposited into the vessel. This is called a stent. Okay, a stent is just like chicken wire, and it keeps the vessel open. The problem is that stents are foreign, and our bodies don't react to foreign things. I mean, that's how we defend against our foreign invasion. And so even though it may have taken, let's say, 70 years or 60 years for the person to develop that degree of coronary artery occlusion, if you put in a foreign object, that can reocclude overnight, or it can occlude on the next day. So you have to give Plavix to prevent the platelets from occluding that newly reopened artery. It's because you've precipitated a potential event. So let me try to go back to the beginning here, if I could. So those are the interventional cardiologists. This is the left anterior descending artery. I think I'm going to try to go back here. So that wire is inserting the dye. Okay, so this artery right there is the, I believe this is the circumflex. This is the LAD, as we call it. And you notice right there, there seems to be a hole there. I mean, there's no line there, right? I mean, you see a line there, you see a line there, but it's sort of blocked there. So what happens is the dye is leaking through. Some of it gets through, but it's not forming the area of the occlusion. This is where this is the blockage right there. And if this doesn't get open, then eventually this gets all blocked, and then you end up with no blood flow distal to the heart. This is where the apex is. Okay. So there's the catheter. It's like 4 feet tall. You can see this is the femoral artery. They're weaving it up the vena cava, up into the aortic arch, into, this is the left, there it is, right there. Just that simple. Okay, I mean, obviously it takes a little while. Let me back it up again. Up the aortic arch, into the left anterior. Okay, so this is plaque. Okay, this is the guide wire. This is the balloon and the stent all in one. So they'll inflate it, and then they'll pull a little catheter back out, and the stent will remain. Of course, there's what we call rupture. We've got a perforation, and people can die just from that, a ruptured a vessel. But these things are pretty pliable. You know, our vessels can really undergo a lot of pressure, and unless there's a aneurysm, it's usually pretty safe. The mortality rate of angioplasty is less than 1%. But, you know, it's not zero, so it's not something you want to do unless you absolutely have to. Okay, so you can see the stainless steel mesh here. And when this catheter goes out, it's going to be nice and patent. Okay, and that's what we want, patency. All right, now we're going to show you, maybe not. Let me try to go back if I could and show you that new vessel with the patency. You know, hold on. No, you leave it there. And, I mean, if it gets occluded, then you can go in there and try to pull it out. Okay, so see this? Nice, big, thick vessel. And everything's coming down here, which is what you want, right? Remember before I was a little tight? We couldn't even see it was like a thin line. There was nothing there. Now you have this a truck can go through here. So this is what we want. All right, so Plavix plays a key role. I would suspect that you probably have people who you know that have a stent in their veins and are better for it.
I'm not an Apple guy, so I have trouble. Bear with me.
Okay, so this is the pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic interactions of Plavix. So you have your phenotypes here. You know what UM, EM, IM, PM. These are the clopidogrel active metabolite levels, and you can see here that the PMs have the lowest level, and that's because they're not producing the prodrug, the drug from the prodrug. That's the bad news. Now, there's also a pharmacodynamic interaction, and we measure that by a test called platelet aggregation. And what we do is we take a little bit of blood, we throw it into a tube, we add an agonist, something that will cause the platelets to aggregate, and we watch them clump in a spectrophotometer. And the rate that it clumps is a function of the activity. And so what we do is we do the platelet function test before and after you give Plavix. And what you want to see is that the aggregation is inhibited when the patient's on Plavix. And this is a slide. The bottom part here is the change from the before and after. That what you'd like to see is a big change. And if you don't see much of a change, like in the poor metabolizer, then the drug is not working. And we see poor platelet aggregometry, or rather, we see no change in aggregometry even in the wild type, in the people who have 2C19, STAR1, STAR1. And that's because there are some additional genetic effects that allow the drug to not work. So it's a combination of a pharmacokinetic and a pharmacodynamic, just like Plavix is, just like warfarin is. This is the allele frequency, star 2, star 3 for 2C19. You'll notice that most of the people have variants of star 2. There is really no allele frequencies for star 3 except for the Asian population, and then it's 5%. This is the American Heart Association guidance for using Plavix to prevent secondary vascular disease. It's everybody who is on one or more of these antiplatelet drugs. I just want to briefly discuss how we do measurements because I'm kind of waiting for the last minute to tell you the results of your tests because then after that you might not listen to me. We have a couple of different technologies. We have what we call gene SNP arrays. These are micro arrays that allow us to do testing. And we're in the process now of transitioning to next-generation sequencing. So we are trying to move into the new generation. One thing that people have touted is that rather than do genotyping on demand, somebody is on Plavix, do genotyping of 2C9. Someone on warfarin, do 2C VCOR. Why not have this information done up front? And this is what 23andMe is trying to do. 23andMe is trying to say, well, we can give you the genotypes for all the relevant genes. And I think they kind of went too far. And what we really need, I think, which is most useful, is a pharmacogenomic genotype that we can just carry with us, maybe in our driver's license in a chip, so that when the day comes that you'll need a drug that might have influences on one of these genetic variances, the data will be there. We don't need to do them on demand. We'll have them in perpetuity. All right, so let's get down to it. So what I have here are the genotypes for several of the genes that we're going to be talking about, a couple others we haven't yet talked about, and they will be on the website. So this is a wild type, STAR1. These individuals should be fine, no worries. Remember now, the FDA approval is based on dosing to meet the masses, and these people are the masses. You're fine. Now, some of you are heterozygous, STAR1, STAR2, reduced metabolism. Okay, so reduced metabolism doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad, because it's not half, it's more like 3/4 of your metabolism. And besides, we have other genes that sort of take over when these drugs aren't being metabolized to the fullest extent. So STAR1, STAR2 is not really that bad, but it's something that you need to be concerned about. People, however, who are STAR2, the homozygous, okay, so drugs that are metabolized by 2C19 will not work. These are going to require some alternate medications in order to maintain efficacy. So this was one of your colleagues from a couple of years ago who took this class, and then we interviewed her afterwards to see what she thought about this. This was written up in the UCSF magazine, her story. Turns out her grandmother had a stroke and was given clopidogrel, which apparently didn't work. And we found on her that she was a genetic variances for 2C19. And it sort of clicked. It kind of says, oh, now I get it. Now I understand. And she started to cry because she now understood what she was going to school for. This is what she went to school for, to learn these things, to understand, to help people in the future. We didn't have genotyping for her at the time that that she underwent these problems, and maybe in the future we will. This is really what it's all about. Some of you are STAR 17, okay? STAR 17 is a hypermetabolism genotype, and it's, you can see across the board here. And so there you are. So what does that mean? Well, you're kind of like flash, you know, speedy, you know, just you're going to break down the drug faster. And in the case of clopidogrel, that might mean that you might break down the drug to produce too much active metabolite, and you might be at risk for bleeding. You know, if you can't clot, you can't form aggregation, then you might even bleed. And then we have one individual who is a mixed bag. They have a poor metabolism gene for one allele and then the hypermetabolism gene for the other allele. So you'd think, well, okay, that must be that you're wild type, right? Well, I don't know if it works that way. One might be more important than the other. You know, we don't have any studies. We don't know what to do with this person. I'm sorry, whoever it is. Can't help you. You're probably okay. Don't know for sure. So, as I said, we are sort of in transition from a SNP array to next-generation sequencing, and we're trying to validate the oral fluid, the buccal swab procedure, and unfortunately, we had some problems, and we actually were not able to genotype anybody for STAR3. And so those of you who are Asian, you may, in fact, have a STAR3 allele. 5% of you will. And we don't have the technology right now, unfortunately. And so what happens is that in the microarray, if you don't have a SNP, then you get reflex to STAR1, and you get sort of false sense of security. This is why I told you about the technologies that we're doing. If you are one of these people who are Asian and were STAR1, and want to find out if you are STAR3, contact me again. We'll get blood instead of oral fluid because, again, oral fluid, you really have to scrape a lot of cheek cells, and many of you didn't do that. I mean, it's uncomfortable, and next year we're going to go with actual oral fluid. We're going to have people spit into tubes, which is, you know, also not a lot of fun, but, you know, it's better than having
a phlebotomy. So I do apologize that I don't have STAR3 data on many of you. Those of you who are not Asian, you don't have to worry because there's no frequency of STAR3. So before we leave the
are you going to tell about,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I was, thank you for reminding me. So Esteban and I talked to the district attorney for the state of Hawaii who was suing Bristol-Myers Squibb on the basis of false advertisement for clopidogrel. Okay, so let's think about this. The state of Hawaii is paying for reimbursement costs for this drug for their citizens, of which the majority population is non-Caucasian. You know, they're Indian, they're Asian, they're from the islands, South Pacific. And they have a high prevalence of STAR2 and STAR3, and this drug doesn't work. So why should the state of Hawaii reimburse for drugs that don't work on people? And so we wrote a commentary that basically says that, you know, this is a tip of the iceberg, that there's a much bigger problem, that in general, pharmacogenomic studies don't include minority populations, and that even though the NIH says that you're not allowed to discriminate against ethnicity in enrollment of clinical trials, when you see the clinical trials, they, in fact, don't adhere. So we're trying to change. He, in particular, is trying to change that. He's on the presidential council now for for personalized medicine, and congratulations to him for that. But we need to really get the message that pharmacogenomic testing is for the outliers. It's not for the majority population. And the majority population is where all the studies are being done. Okay, so if you're Caucasian, I hope you're not offended, but you're basically covered, and it's everybody else who needs help, including me. Okay, quickly, I want to get you done here. Irinotecan, this is a colon cancer drug, as I mentioned. It's metabolized by UGT1A1 to produce this glucuronide. If you have a defect in this enzyme, you accumulate the SN38 metabolite. So these are the adverse events, weakness, diarrhea. What we really worry about is bone marrow suppression. People who are homozygous for the mutation have the highest incidence of bone marrow suppression. These are the outcomes here. And this is how the drug is used today. You can either go with 100 milligram or 300 milligrams. If you have the mutation and you go with the higher dose, the probability of a grade 3-4 hematologic toxicity for the STAR28 poor metabolism genotype is four times higher than if you were to use the 100 milligram. On the other hand, if you are wild type or heterozygous, the curve is flat. You can use irinotecan at the highest dose to try to maintain the best therapeutic efficacy possible. Now, in actual practice, we use irinotecan along with other anti-cancer drugs like cisplatin, and so it's not just about this one drug, but you do want to give yourself the best chance, but you don't want to do this either. We have one person who is homozygous, heterozygous, but that person is fine. Again, this is the combination, wild type and heterozygosity. You know, not that you have colon cancer and you're going to need this drug, hopefully, anytime soon. No worries. Oh, I'm sorry, we did try to test, but we found nobody. Okay, hepatitis. Hepatitis is is a test that we do quite a bit here at UCSF. This is a little bit about what hepatitis C is, so I'm not going to worry so much about it. It used to be transmitted through tainted blood, but now it's more contaminated needles. The problem is that if you get acute hepatitis, a vast majority of individuals will develop chronic hepatitis, and then they'll end up with either liver disease or cirrhosis. So that's the bad news. Now, the good news is that we have a lot of new generation antiretroviral therapies that are involved that can improve. This is a little bit of how testing is done. We have laboratory tests that determine
whether or not you are positive or not, and whether or not you need to undergo additional testing to determine the genotype of the virus and the virus load. So there was a GWAS study conducted some 5 years ago that looked at the efficacy of this combination of interferon alpha and ribavirin as a therapy. And what they found was that there is a mutation in the IL-28 locus that predicts therapeutic efficacy for interferon alpha and ribavirin. And this is the data here, that if you are TT genotype or heterozygous TC, you have, this is the median viral load reduction. So this is not a survival curve. This is reducing how much virus you have. So in this situation, you want to be the lower curve, because the lower curve indicates that you have eradicated the virus. And the people who are CC genotype did much better than the individuals who are the TT or the CT genotype for the IL-28B. So we can now predict whether or not this particular therapy works. And a couple of years ago when we started this, there was no alternate therapy that was approved. And so it was FYI at the time. Today, we have sobaquivir. Sobaquivir is a very potent anti-HCV therapy, but it's also about $60,000 a year. So we're using pharmacogenomic testing to predict efficacy for the standard therapy and reserve the more expensive therapies for the people who we know won't be as cured as readily. So this is as much of an economic issue as it is a therapeutic efficacy issue. It's not a toxicity issue. Okay? So these are the people who we tested who have good virological clearance. And these are the people who probably will need to be on a different drug should they develop. Sorry, those are not correct. I'll have to change that. Okay, sorry about showing you these slides just before lunch here. This is Stevens-Johnson syndrome. This is a serious condition, as you can see. Stevens-Johnson syndrome produces a high degree of a allergic multi-system allergy that is associated with a high degree of mortality. And there are a ton of drugs that can produce this, although the majority of these individuals, it's a very rare condition. The exceptions, however, are the anti-gout agents, some of the anti-epileptics, and some of the anti-HIV drugs. And so this is a little bit about how it works. It's a delayed hypersensitivity. It has to do with synthesizing your T cells. So you present your T cells with an antigen. It produces a immune response. And then when you get re-challenged by that same drug a few weeks or a few months later, it says, well, we know this drug, and we're going to attack it. And in doing so, it attacks individuals as well, individual healthy cells. And so these are some of the drugs that have been known to produce Stevens-Johnson syndrome and the particular HLA type, the polymorphisms that are associated with that. So abacavir, for example, is an anti-HIV drug, and we test anybody who has HIV on whom we're thinking about giving this drug to. This is the odds ratio for HLA-B and the development of Stevens-Johnson syndrome. For 5701 and abacavir, it's 1,001. For the 5801 and allopurinol, which is used to treat gout, it's 600-1. And you can see carbamazepine, it's 2,500-1. So in the island of Taiwan, or the country of Taiwan, they have instituted a HLA-B 1502 program for all individuals who are being who have epilepsy and on whom carbamazepine might be considered. And the end result is that Stevens-Johnson syndrome, as developed through carbamazepine, has been eradicated from the island. It was before the testing, they used to get hundreds of cases. This is the impact that pharmacogenomics can have on a country that's forward-thinking. Sorry, I thought I had these slides updated. My apologies. But these aren't even the people in this class. Okay, here is the 5701 data. Low risk. High risk? Do we have anybody? Yes. Let's hope that you don't need allopurinol. Oh, I'm sorry, this is abacavir. So as I said, we were having trouble with the buccal swabs. We had a couple of people who just didn't get enough DNA, which means that you didn't scrape enough. Maybe there wasn't enough fluid. If you want to have testing, please contact me. We will do it right. I apologize for that. So pharmacogenomic testing, as I said over and over, is tailoring treatment for the outlier to increase benefit and reduce harm in people whose drug responses are not average, okay? So those of you who watch Star Trek, you know, they got a new generation of movies now. I'm a longtime Star Trek fan. So I translated this into Star Trek language, okay? Pharmacogenomic testing. The needs of the few outweigh the needs of the many. This is not like Spock, you know, the needs of the many outweigh. It's the opposite, okay? Well, thank you very much. Anybody else has any additional questions? Yeah, so 2D6, we're also in transition to a full sequence genotype. And, you know, part of the requirement for us doing this is that the test has to be available in the CLIA lab, and it's not available. So we don't have that data. Nor can we get it. Yeah. Yes. I will get the new slides.
So Dr. Wu volunteered to do this, so I want to say thank you to him and on behalf of all of us, but thank you.
It's a work in progress. We're still trying to learn how to do this.
This is a first. I want you guys to know that we have a few minutes. So I want to take like 2 minutes. This class, this portion of the class, came out of a focus group with this class several years ago on what we should do. We initiated genetic testing for a couple of students. I think we did 15 students, and then they requested that we roll it out to all of the students. And that's what you guys are experiencing now. We, the School of Pharmacy, are trying to launch this precision medicine initiative. We did a great seminar a couple months ago where we invited keynote speakers. We're doing it here with this class. If anyone wants to be involved next year, Dr. Guglielmo would like to roll this out for all the schools, not just the School of Pharmacy, but medicine, nursing, and dentistry in the graduate program. You guys could be involved in that. If anyone wants a TA for this, this class works really well. We have a PharmD TA. Also, we're trying to expose people to industry. So that's one of the benefits that will come out of this. So if you're interested, talk to the current TAs, which are Dalga, John, Priya, Dor, Pin. Those are all people that have done this in the past. Again, thank you, Dr. Wu, and look forward to your feedback. Great, thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Wu. Yeah. See you next time.
I think we're going to continue our show now.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. We have an extra 10 minutes. You guys can sit tight. We'll get the show started again.
Okay, so most likely to get lost in UCSF, we have a tie between
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks. For those of you who are just joining us, we're just continuing our Student Choice Award Pharmacy Edition. Where we left off was most likely to get lost in UCSF.
Go ahead.
So we actually have a tie for this position. We would like, the award goes to Sarush Aydun and Mercy Tang. Congratulations. All right, moving on. Most likely to be our boss in 10 years. Whoever this is, remember me, you can hire me as your hot secretary in 10 years. Most likely to be our boss in 10 years goes to Brandon Conley. Congratulations.
I'll be gentle, I promise.
Most likely to win a dance-off. Maybe our boss can have a thing or two to tell you about this. This goes to Stephen Samuels. I think he's going to give us a little presentation right now. Thank you. Moving on to most likely to enjoy a quiet evening in. We wanted to recognize some people that are maybe not as loud and obnoxious as the rest of us. And this award goes to Renee Castillo. Congratulations.
So most likely to help an old lady cross the street, we also have a tie. And they are Edna Mao and Margarita Chinova.
Ideally, all of us would help an old lady cross the street, but if it just had to be one of us or two of us, I think we know who.
Most optimistic.
Thank you very
Congratulations.
Much.
Next we have Most Reliable. Now there are a lot of candidates that were nominated for this one. My personal favorite was Everyone Has Let Me Down. However, the winner of Most Reliable is our ASSP President-elect, Jessica Lee. Congratulations. Moving on to Most Spirited. Most Spirited. The winner of this award is Kimmy Tam.
Thank you.
This is not rigged in any way, I promise. Next we have Selfie Royalty, Selfie King or Selfie Queen. The winner of this award is Her Royal Highness, Mia Pollack. I think she's too busy taking selfies right now. Next we have Life of the Party. The winner of this award is Vic Arias! Come on down, Vic Arias. Congratulations. And finally, last but not certainly not least, we have Biggest Dreamer. Now, Kimmy and I personally think this is the, what's the word? The most admirable of all the superlatives. And again, we have a tie. The winners for Biggest Dreamer are Anna Cruz and Micah Hazier. Come on down.
Thank you.
So these are all the superlatives that we have for this. Thank you. Congratulations. So these are all the superlatives that we have for this year. Unfortunately, there's only so much space in the therapeutic window, so we had to limit the number of superlatives to 19. However, we just wanted you all to know that if we could have, we would have had categories for each and every single one of you, because everyone here contributes to our class in different ways. So thank you for your participation. Let's give another round of applause to our winners. Winners, if you could stay by so we could take a group picture, please come on down. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good night. I think he's waiting outside the room. Winners, if you could please come on down.
Thank you.
We have a lot of people, like 22 or something.
I'm not dressed like a boss today.
Winners, get your asses down here.
Hurry, we're like this.
Want to
fuck close
to the thing? Here's the bill for a month. You should change it to the first slide. Kevin, take a picture of us.
And we'll
Yeah.